Okay, folks, a very big welcome back to Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And, Leslie Ann, you've been on your travels, haven't you? So let's have a first-hand account of the nightmares that airports are bringing to travellers at the moment, the frustrations, the three-hour queues, the aircraft sitting on the tarmac for 6 hours and then being told it's going nowhere. Was it a horrible experience?
Well, you know, I sometimes wonder whether I'm living in a different country.
Right.
Because I got an email from Ryanair. I was flying from Stansted to Perugia in Italy.
Yep.
And I was going away for a few days for the 40th wedding anniversary party of some very dear old friends.
Oh, that's great. Well done.
And got this email from Ryanair. And they said, please turn up at Stansted to join the check-in queue for your flight at least 3 hours in advance.
Yep.
So I thought, okay, I better make that four because I'm always overcautious. I was a girl guide.
Right, very good.
So, you know, up at 3 a.m, left the house at 5, yeah. Drive to Stansted. My parking experience was positive. Yeah. I pre-booked, as one does, yeah, for Stansted Airport. Get inside the airport. Yes, there were a lot of people. Mm. But no, it wasn't hysterical. There was no panic going on.
Right.
Everybody was very calm. Mm. Got through the process where you go through security.
Yep.
And I always get done, by the way, every single time.
Yeah.
I'm the one that gets hauled to one side and they take everything out of my bag.
Really?
I must look like a criminal.
Yeah.
So I always anticipate that. I know that's coming. Mm-hmm. And weirdly, the guy confiscated my shampoo and conditioner, even though they were just small 50ml bottles.
Yeah,
he took them away.
That's weird. The fluid thing. I thought we'd go over that.
Yeah, well, it was odd because he seemed to be taking something, some small little thing, away from everybody he was processing.
Right.
Anyway, got through that, got through the other side, went and had a bite to eat. The flight was on time. Yes, it was full.
Mm-hmm.
You expect that these days. All flights are full nowadays. And it left on time, it arrived on time, and the reverse process was exactly the same.
That's great.
And I hate to say it, but we know about the modern media. The media today is not the one we worked in.
Well, it's pictures, and isn't it, all the time?
It is pictures, and it's constant. It's breaking news. It has to be a panic all the time.
Mm.
So they hone in on the negatives. And
Ms. Jones,
in a way,
you're accusing your fellow journalists of exaggeration and sensationalism.
Yes, I am.
And,
yes, I am. Because for every person who's had a negative flying experience, there is a me who's had a very positive one.
Right.
So I think you have to be prepared. If you're flying somewhere, you have to take on board, pardon the pun, the fact that there are going to be a lot of people, that a lot of processing goes on, blah, blah, blah. And you have to just calm your mind, get there early, and be attentive and be up for it.
Well,
but it's not half as bad as the media are making out. I'm sorry to say, it just isn't.
Right. Ooh, well, you know, it's a rap on the knuckles for some of our colleagues. But anyway, there you go. But listen, that's a very uplifting message, actually, because you're absolutely right. The only vision I've got of travel at the moment is it's all utter chaos. It's going to be even worse in about 2 weeks' time because it's announced this morning the rail unions are going to go on strike for a week. Well, it's not a week. It's the 21st, the 23rd and the 25th of June. So it is a week in effect, but they're saying, oh, they're only one-day strikes. Oh, come off it. We all know that it never gets back together again the following day, and then that evening you go on strike again. It's pathetic, and I'm so glad that you've outlined your good experience in travelling, because what I don't want is this country to look dishevelled. I don't want it to look as disorganised. I don't want it to look like we can't run things here anymore, because the rest of the world focuses on what happens in London, because we have airports like Heathrow and that sort of thing, you know. So
it's so true, and we've just delivered the most magnificent bank holiday weekend celebrating Her Majesty the Queen's 70th anniversary on the throne.
Yeah.
The Platy Jube, as it's being called.
Yes.
It made me so proud. I don't remember having felt that proud of my country and my capital city since Olympics 2012. Yeah. Do you remember?
Yes.
And everybody said, oh, there'll be terrorist attacks. It'll all fall to bits. It'll go horribly wrong. Yeah. Nothing's going to work. Yeah. It was a very positive experience.
No,
and I'm really proud of this country right now. No. The thing I'm upset about with the train strikes pending is all the millions of kids who are doing their GCSEs who won't be able to get to their schools and colleges to sit their exams. And that's already kicking in. And that is a shameful situation.
Yeah. No,
they need to provide for these kids.
Yeah, I totally agree. No, I like you, I was very proud of the... I thought it went on too long. I thought 4 days is too long. People are going to get tired of it. But then I actually wrapped myself on the knuckles on Sunday afternoon, which I found to be the best day of all. Because that parade, you know, with the 1950s bus and then the 60s bus, the 70s bus, Cliff Richard, I thought it was fantastic, outstanding. And like you, I felt, wow, this is a window into the world. And so you're right. What I don't want to see are scenes of chaos in this country that we can't run things anymore, because we're very good at organising things. We've organised things which are going on around the world, you know, that we started 200 years ago, you know, legal systems and all sorts of things. So
democracy, we are the birthplace of democracy, whatever parts of the world think of that.
Yeah,
but going back to the Jubilee, what was your favourite moment?
Well, I don't have an actual favourite moment. I didn't sit here, you know, like 24 hours a day watching it. I was in and out, and I had the telly on. It was in the background, all that kind of stuff. But I think, again, I think that last day and the bus parade down the Mall, with it, you know, going through the decades. I'll tell you what struck me. I reckon that one really great member of the royal family, who I think is a credit to all of them, is Mike Tindall. Because he's married to Zara, right? Zara is Princess Anne's daughter, obviously. And we've always felt that the Princess Anne side of the family was the most grounded. You know what I mean? She didn't give her children titles. They don't have royal protection. And Zara's always been independent and feisty and pursued her own career as a horsewoman and all that kind of stuff. And first indication of it was when they were going into St. Paul's Cathedral and she was literally hanging on Mike Tindall's arm. You know what I mean? Like any married couple would, you know, linked arms, like that kind of stuff. But then later in the day, when they were watching the parade, Mike Tindall, a former England rugby player, obviously England international rugby player, he was sitting next to Boris Johnson eating a bar of chocolate. So, you know, he's sitting there, he's talking to the Prime Minister. Boris Johnson at that time had been told, although we didn't know, that there was going to be a challenge to his authority and he was going to have to face a vote of no confidence. And there was Mike Tindall, you know, the husband of the daughter of Princess Anne, just idly sitting there chatting. He didn't look at all uncomfortable. He was slumped forward, turned his head to Boris, had a few words with him. I think he's a great guy.
It wasn't product placement, was it?
No, I don't think it's product placement at all. I interviewed him a few times when he was a rugby player, and, you know, he was always quite down to earth and frank. But I think the way he's fitted into the royal family is an example to anybody who wants to join the firm, as it's known.
Look, they are a family like anybody else. There was that wonderful moment at the concert. Obviously, I didn't watch all this because I was in Italy partying away for another reason. But you see the clips on the news, don't you, after the fact? And there was that wonderful moment where they've got a lip reader to interpret what members of the royal family are saying to each other. And little Louis, who stole the show on several occasions, is a bit restless in the box, as a little child would be. And Prince William leans across to Prince Charles and says, Grandpa, can Louis sit on your lap?
Yes.
And Prince Charles goes, of course. And along crawls this little boy. Yeah. And you think, that is just a classic normal family.
It is.
Where the little boy is kind of up in, you know, he's fidgety. And so he goes and sits on his granddad's lap. Yeah. I thought it was very sweet.
Yeah. No.
I absolutely loved the Queen and Paddington Bear. I thought that was
fabulous.
But
she pulled the marmalade sandwich out of her handbag. It was a classic moment. People all over the world bursting into tears, you know.
But what I could have done without the concert, the Americans. We are British. We've produced some of the finest musical artists in the world, in history. Why do we have to have Diana Ross, Alicia Keys, Adam Lambert?
Work that out.
don't get it. We've got enough of our own.
I totally agree. It's like we said in a previous podcast, Tom Cruise sticking his nose in all over the place, you know, into like British ceremonial things and all that.
Yeah, why couldn't we have Daniel Craig?
I totally agree.
The ultimate in James Bond.
Yeah, I totally. Well, of course, he did the old ceremony, didn't he, at the Olympics, but that went down very well. Why not bring him back? That's a very good point, Miss Jones, that passed me by. But yeah, I totally agree. Talking about families, by the way, as you and I are recording this, which will be out in a few minutes, Petronella Wyatt is talking on TV about her relationship with Boris Johnson. Now, just for our millions of listeners around the world, Petronella Wyatt is I suppose you could say she's a society girl, and she worked at Spectator, the magazine, when Boris, I think, was the editor, and an affair took place, and I think that, you know, it was quite an intimate affair and all that. And now she's...
Well, it was so intimate that she underwent an abortion after it.
That is what has been stated, yeah. And I don't think it's ever been denied, has it? But she's popping up now all over the place on telly. Now, obviously, since the last podcast we did, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, is a massively changed man in the sense that he was Prime Minister without challenge last time we made a podcast, and now he is a badly damaged Prime Minister with 41% of his backbenchers indicating they don't have any confidence in him anymore. But at the same time, old Petronella Wyatt comes along and says, oh, I think I'll stick the boot in here and talk about the illicit affair. I think that might be bad form, Miss Jones.
I think it's very bad form on her part. It doesn't make her look good. It makes her look like a slapper.
Yeah.
You know, this was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a very long time ago.
He's been in and out of two marriages since then. Well, he's still in the current one. But, you know, you are not the same person. Yeah. I think we change in a cellular way, in a biological way, every 7 years, we're a completely different person, not to mention psychologically and everything else he's gone through as well. He is not the person she had an affair with. I don't like the look of him at the moment. I think he looks very unhealthy.
Yeah.
He looks perplexed. This kind of thing isn't going to do him any good. It's like Dominic Cummings. You know, why do you have to be so bitter and so vengeful?
Yes. I agree.
Towards a person, why not just draw the line? It's all about drawing the line,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I
draw the line and move on.
I totally agree. I mean, you know, I've had situations in my life I look back on and I could feel extremely bitter, you know, forced out of jobs and people who've, you know, collaborated against you, stabbed you in the back. We've all had it. We do in a business place because other people try to take opportunity all the time. If they see a weakness and you're looking the other way, or as in my case, confined to a hospital bed for 7 months waiting for a heart transplant or whatever, you know, and it's difficult to fight back. But I'm not bitter. Let me stress that to the millions who are listening here. What I'm saying is these things happen, and you're right. The only way you can go forward, as John Lennon once said, how can I go forward if I don't know which way I'm facing? And I believe in that. I think, you know, you can't live for yesterday. You can't live for tomorrow. You've got to live for the moment. And living for the moment means deal with what's going on now.
And for all his faults, I think Boris is very good at that.
Yes, I do.
He is very good at dealing with what's on the table right in front of him. And if this could be a classic case of we don't know what we've got till it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, we know he's screwed up. We know he's told lies. He has a history of that. He's been sacked from more jobs than anyone for having been dishonest. But that doesn't make any difference to who he is now and what he's dealing with.
No, yeah.
And I think we need to proceed with caution because we could throw him to the wolves and then end up with somebody even worse.
Well, all of that, you just don't know in politics, do you? As Harold Wilson once said, a week is a long time in politics. 24 hours can be a long time in politics for Mr. Johnson. My old friend Andrew Pearce, the columnist for the Daily Mail and, you know, political sketch writer.
I've got a lot of time for him, actually.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And I, you know, I bump into him sometimes in TV studios and that kind of stuff. I've got a lot of time for him. But he told a great story this morning about how Boris got sacked. The lady we just mentioned, I've forgotten the name now.
Petronella Wyatt.
Yeah, one of the reasons she's on is because Boris got sacked by Michael Howard, who was then leader of the opposition for lying about his affair with Petronella Wyatt. He said he hadn't had an affair with her, and then Michael Howard found out that he had. Excuse me, my voice is going a bit. And so he didn't sack
him. Don't get overexcited, Mike.
No. He didn't sack him for the affair. He sacked him because he lied to him. But Andrew Pearce then tells the story of the first time Boris got sacked in journalism. Andrew said it was from the Times. I thought it was the Financial Times, but I'm not going to argue with Andrew. But Boris wrote a story. And in the story, he quoted a bloke to stand up his story. And the bloke happened to be his godfather. So he thought it won't matter, you know, because he's my godfather. And unfortunately, the godfather's best friend was Charlie Wilson, who was the editor of the Times. Oh, it must have been the Times. That's absolutely right, because Charlie Wilson was the editor of the Times, who then promptly rang up the Times and said, "I don't know why you've put this story in your paper. I never spoke to Boris." And Boris got the sack.
I mean, oh, dear.
That's a bit unfortunate, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. But, you know, the bottom line here is let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Yeah. Which one of these people who sacked Boris for having lied about something quite insignificant has never told a lie?
Yeah, well, you could ask that of all of us, couldn't you? Now, talking about journalists, magazines and all that, Miss Jones, I'm fascinated by the world of women's magazines, and particularly as I've just read a review of a new book written about Anna Wintour, who, of course, is the most legendary women's magazine editor in history. The film The Devil Wears Prada was certainly based on her, and I think she's been at that magazine for something like 40 years or something, hasn't she?
It's a long, long time, yeah. Nuclear Wintour, as they call her.
She's 72 now. It says at 72, she now seems impregnable. She is the creative director of all Condé Nast magazines, from Vogue down to Golf Digest and Wired. So most powerful female journalist in the world, and a legion of sort of stories are in this review of the book called Anna, the Biography. But I noticed recently, a magazine I read every week is called You Magazine, and it comes with the Mail on Sunday. And one of the reasons I read it is because Liz Jones's column is on the back page of it every week, and it's required reading. But I noticed the editor there has changed. Used to be a lady called, I can't remember, but it's now a lady called
Joe Elvin left.
Joe Elvin, yeah.
And Jackie Annesley, who was at the Mail for many, many years. Right. I think she left and went somewhere else recently, but they brought her back.
Yeah.
I have a great interest in You Magazine always because I worked there for many years during the 90s when Nick Gordon was the editor.
Yeah.
And the magazine in those days was equivalent to the Sunday Times magazine.
Right.
It wasn't a women's mag.
Right,
as such.
Yeah.
It was a magazine that covered stories all over the world. And the punchline was stories about ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
Right.
We set a lot of stories in Africa. Yeah. We saved gorillas. I used to get regularly sent to the States for 6 weeks at a time, you know, come back with half a dozen cover stories, which I always did because that was the brief. And of course, expenses in those days were unlimited.
Yes.
You literally could go anywhere and do anything in the name of a story.
Yeah.
But then they decided they wanted to try and make this a magazine with a cover price. Mm. So a standalone magazine as opposed to a supplement that comes with a newspaper.
Yeah.
And in order to achieve that, the powers that be decided to bring in a tried and tested women's magazine editor. Mm. So that was Dee Nolan, if you remember.
Yeah, I remember Dee Nolan.
Australian lady, so of course her nickname was Nolene.
Yep.
And in she came, out went Nick, and she changed it into what we referred to as lipstick and tights.
Right, okay.
You know, it wasn't nearly as serious, not nearly as eclectic, not nearly as interesting.
Right, okay. And it's been like that ever since.
You'd have to primarily say that it's about fashion and makeup and emotions nowadays.
Yeah.
All of which Liz Jones covers admirably in her column.
Yeah.
And really, they could do better with the rest of the magazine, I think.
Yeah, I only ever read the Liz Jones column because there's nothing else in it for me as a man. And I've always been trying to work out where the balance in Mail on Sunday is for the male audience, you know what I mean? But it is, you're absolutely right, it's totally a women's magazine now. And I'm not being rude to women and all that, but I'm not interested in lipsticks or, you know, I'm not interested in a new range of shoes or anything like that. So, look, I'm sure it's very successful because the MOS, I think, is the biggest selling Sunday newspaper, but they decided to focus on, you know, the female gender, and they appear to have done it very successfully. Now, I'm going to sing you a song, Miss Jones.
She
wore an itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini. Da, 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 da. Now, the reason I'm singing you that is because the guy who wrote it, a guy called Paul Vance, has sadly died at the age of 92. But he was a prolific songwriter who also wrote something for Perry Como.
I know the one, Catch a Falling Star.
Catch a Falling Star. How does that go?
Catch a falling star and put
it. Oh, that's the one. Right, well done.
Never let it fade.
Yeah, I recognise that. The minute you broke into song, I see.
Not that I can sing, so sorry about that.
No. But what an iconic song Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny was. And
well, yeah, but you know what's interesting about Paul Vance? He was one of the Brill Building stable, that famous songwriting factory in New York during the 60s that produced the likes of Burt Bacharach, Carole King, Neil Sedaka, Paul Simon, all of those guys who had great international careers having come out of a little songwriting factory on Broadway. That built is still there. It's not a songwriting factory anymore, but you can walk down to the address and see the entrance to it.
Really?
Of course, that all changed during the 70s when the music business became about albums instead of about singles.
Right.
And then the industry in America migrated from New York to the West Coast.
Yeah.
And it all became about the long player. So that's when we went into the era of the Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, and so on, and left hit singles behind to some extent.
Right. Okay, that's amazing. The inspiration for the song, I'm reading this now from a tribute to Paul Vance, came from a family trip to Long Island. His wife had bought their infant daughter, Paula, a new bathing costume, but when some boys made fun of her skimpy attire, shouting that she should put more clothes on, she retreated to the locker room and refused to come out. When she finally summoned the courage to come into the water, a bikini bottom came undone and floated away. By the time Vance reached home, he had written 90% of the lyrics with his customary writing partner, Lee Pockris, who finished the song off in the next half hour. It was then recorded by 16-year-old Brian Hyland, and the track reached number one in the US. Isn't that amazing how songs just happen like that?
Well, all songs are inspired by moments in real life.
Yes, they are. You know,
the best songs tell a story.
Yeah.
And I think so many of them are based in actual things that happen to people.
Yeah.
It capture a moment in time. That's really what it's about.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. You're absolutely right. Talking about pop stars, by the way, I mean, look, I don't want to sound as old as I am, and I don't want to start reminiscing about the 60s, but even I was shocked to see an advert in a newspaper promoting Herman's Hermits on the Isle of Wight. I mean, good God, you know, Herman's Hermits were the early 60s. How they can possibly be still going these days. What was the name of the lead singer of Herman Hermits again?
Was Peter Noon.
Peter Noon, that's right, yeah.
I had him on my wall. I thought he was a real heartthrob.
No, you're joking.
No, I'm not.
What was it?
You know, there's a kind of hush all over the world tonight was one of their big hits.
Well, the other one was No Milk Today, My Baby's Gone Away. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, that was a strange song, wasn't it?
But,
I mean, you would probably be amazed to know how many of these silver 60s acts are still touring.
No, you're right.
I was yesterday at, you know, our Scribs lunch that we have twice a year, the summer lunch yesterday. I was chatting to Frank Allen, who's an old friend of mine. He's in his late 70s. He's been on the road for 50 years with the Searchers.
Searchers, blimey.
And they came off the road about, must be 3 years ago now, because basically John McNally, the guitarist's wife, Mary, said she would leave John if he didn't stop touring because their entire marriage had been about him being on the road.
Yeah.
But then somebody came along with a post-pandemic offer and they decided they missed touring and they're going back on the road next year.
Is that... go on.
Yeah, I forgot what I was going
to say. I was going to say, was that Needles and Pins?
Yes, but they were a covers band, really. They didn't really write hits, but they Yeah, famously had covers with hits by other people. Yeah. But yeah, they're another example of bands from that era who are just going to keep going till they drop.
I totally agree. And when one of them does drop, they just put a replacement in and then they have a dispute about whether they can use the name Bay City Rollers or not. You know what I mean?
Well, there's a lot of that. Yeah,
all the legal disputes,
Yeah, it's like with the Rolling Stones, who are celebrating their 60th anniversary, can we believe, this year.
Yeah.
Keith Richards, the guitarist, has always said, the Stones will end when I drop dead on stage.
Yeah, it will.
And I think that's true. I think they'll make that happen.
Yeah.
Because it's such a great historical thing, isn't it, to be remembered by.
Oh, totally.
He literally died with his boots on. I think somehow or another they will make that happen.
I think you're right. And then Jagger can't perform on his own. It'll all be over. I totally
agree. He never could. No. I mean, he's had two periods in his career where he's tried to break away from the band and have a solo career. But his solo albums were never successful.
No, I totally agree. When I was in America in the 80s, he tried to break away and he made a song called Give Me Just Another Night, Just Another Night With You. But for some unknown reason, unlike Rod Stewart and Cliff Richard, you're absolutely right. The world just wouldn't accept Jagger as a solo singer, would they?
Because he's not really a singer. And people don't like me saying this, but it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
He's a character singer. So he invents these aspects to his voice. And it's almost like he's impersonating other people.
Yeah, no, you're right.
He's got a few voices that he does,
yeah.
a few different. He's got the very high falsetto one, and he's got the sort of low growly one. But it's not a proper singing voice. It's all from the throat.
No, I totally agree.
And it doesn't work without the instrumental backing.
No.
So it's all part of the whole, you know, it's the chemistry that people are drawn to. It's not just how Mick Jagger sounds.
Yeah, no, that's a great analysis of it. You're right. He almost talks his way through some records. And you're absolutely right. Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in today. You're listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Now, Miss Jones, you are a proud mother of three children. Your eldest son, I think, is on tour in Italy. You must be so comforted by the success of his career. What were you thinking when you read that Michael Owen, an outstanding footballer who led the front line at Liverpool and Newcastle, Real Madrid, and, of course, for England, expressed doubts about his young daughter, who I think is only 19, going into Love Island, which, of course, started again a couple of nights ago. I've never seen it myself and don't intend to watch it, but Michael Owen's a bit worried she's going to become somewhat, I don't know, affected, corrupted, call it what you will.
Well, he has every reason to be fearful. I don't watch this show either, but my two daughters watch it avidly.
Yeah.
It's their guilty secret. It's a thinly disguised sex show.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And no father wants to be confronted with his teenage daughter's sex life.
Yes, well, that's absolutely
true. It's a bottom line. You know, all fathers would feel like
this.
So she's bound to be corrupted. Mm. There's bound to be fallout. And he's going to be the one picking up the pieces. So he has all my sympathy.
Michael Owen's an interesting character himself, actually. He's now a TV commentator and all that, but he's been involved massively in the horse racing world. He's been in the Royal Carriage at Ascot, and he frequents Chester Racecourse a lot. That's my hometown, and he's got a boxer and all. Very interesting guy, and, you know, he racing's his whole life now, but he was a great footballer. But, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's difficult to know. Talking about children, by the way, he's been successful. You've been keeping tabs on young Ewan Blair. This is Tony Blair's son. I think he's not a little boy anymore. He's 38. But he now has a business worth over £700 million. I mean, we all know that Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister, three successive victories as a Labour Prime Minister, amassed a sizeable fortune in retirement, something which Boris Johnson, I'm sure, has got his eye on at the moment. But Tony Blair made hundreds of millions, invested a lot of it in property. He got paid for consultancies and huge salaries to advise world corporations. But his son has outdone him by a mile. And I've heard people sniping and saying, well, it's not fair. His dad must have helped him with the leg up, given him some money and all that. There's nothing better, is there, than seeing your child doing very well in life and meaning you don't have to worry about that child for the rest of your life.
unless you're a former Labour Prime Minister, and we're talking a Labour Prime Minister's son, who has benefited so bountifully from that position. And Labour is supposed to be all about inclusion and making society and life and work better for all. This smacks of, you know, it's all right for me, Jack. He's got this company called The Multiverse or Multiverse. I had a look at it, and it seems to be the plain truth that this company offers absolutely no valid or marketable product. It's a training provider. It's also a charitable trust. It relies on donations and income from events and that kind of thing. So you've got a question, really. How is it possible for somebody who runs a charitable trust to make so much personal wealth?
Well, it's a good question, but the world of finance often eludes a lot of us, doesn't it? People seem to make fortunes and they come out of nowhere and go nowhere. One of the aspects of his business is to try and convince people not to go to university, which is a bit ironic considering his father's dogma when he became prime minister was education, education, education. But this thing that he runs, whatever it is, I'm not sure what it is.
It's about apprenticeships. So it's, encouraging young people into apprenticeships to have a vocational career rather than go to university and then wonder what to do next.
No, that's absolutely right. Sorry, it says here, has been lobbying the government to consider scrapping exams and university degrees for many people. I'm in favour of that. I think far too many young kids go to university and waste their blinking lives, to be honest. And then they come out of university, they go on a gap year, right? And that's another waste of 12 months. And then eventually...
Well, they normally have the gap year before they go to university.
No, but I think if you've spent 3 years getting a degree, get into the into the labour market. Don't go off to Australia for a year and waste your time. By the time you get back, other people who left at the age of 18 are in well-developed careers. I've always said that. And, you know, I did 1 year at the University of the Trent, which is called Trent Polytechnic in those days. And then I decided this is not for me. I want to get into the labour market. I wanted to be a journalist anyway. And I was lucky enough to get a job on the Chester Chronicle. And the rest is, as you might say, history. But anyway, look, you know, it's horses for courses. And if people can do well in life, I generally speaking support them and don't want to sort of, you know, put the boot in on them. Nams Jones, what do you think about this? It's only come to my attention, actually, just recently. The Crown Prosecution Service came under fire yesterday for hiring to a new diversity role a transgender activist who wants women from now on to be called, and I can't pronounce it, Womxn, W-O-M-X-N.
Okay. Well,
I know it's ridiculous.
I have very mixed feelings about this stuff. We have set back the cause of women by hundreds of years by kowtowing to these people who seem to think that women shouldn't exist anymore. So what we're doing is eliminating the importance of females in the modern world and taking it right back to a situation where women don't count. That's the bottom line. There are all kinds of opinions about the transgender movement and so on. It's two different things, you know, personally and politically. If you feel trapped in a body that isn't the one you want to live in, there are things you can do about that. We don't have to change the whole damn world to accommodate individuals' feelings. We have to be mindful and respectful, and people can be whoever and whatever they like. That's quite right in the 21st century. But we don't have to force it on everybody else.
No, I tell you, it drives me mad, honestly. And there's all this debate at the moment about what's the biological definition of a woman. But anyway, look, that's all above my head. Do you know what I thought was very funny? BBC apologises for Goodman remark on foreign muck. So Len Goodman is the Strictly Come Dancing judge. You know, he's on some television show. They're talking about diets and food and all that. He was asked if he liked coronation chicken. And he said, no. He said, I never eat coronation chicken. My nan used to call it all foreign muck. But I have to say it was delicious, so tasty. But when he called it foreign muck, he was then upbraided by, you know, some broadcasting authority and, you know, had to apologise. I mean, foreign muck is just an expression we've all used as kids, haven't we? If, you know, it's a food that our parents put on our plate. Oh, don't like it. It's spaghetti. Where'd it come from? Italy. Oh, that's foreign muck. You know what I mean? How can you possibly upbraid somebody for using the expression foreign muck, particularly somebody of Len Goodman's age?
There are two things very wrong with this story. First of all, that the BBC apologised on his behalf. He's not even a Strictly Come Dancing judge anymore. No. So why is the BBC apologising for him? Second of all, he made very clear that his grandmother said it.
Yes.
It wasn't him saying it. It was reported speech.
Yes.
He wasn't calling it foreign muck. He was just remarking that that's what his grandmother used to say. All of our grandmothers said things like
that.
Exactly. We've all got similar stories. I'm afraid to tell you that my mother still does say things like that.
My mum did before she died.
You know, who's still alive. Yeah. They had different views. Mm. They lived in a different world. Mm. They had different ideas about what foreign was. And don't forget, they lived through two world wars. Yeah. And they'd seen the assault on our country by foreign people, as they would have called them in those days.
Yes, that's right.
So the kind of food that they ate would reasonably have been regarded as foreign muck. Yeah. I don't see that he said anything wrong at all. And I think they've all overreacted as usual.
Oh, completely. You need to get up the clip of a very po-faced Claire Balding, because Claire Balding was hosting the show, which also starred Kirsty Young, right.
We like her.
Yes, that's right. A very po-faced Claire Balding suddenly said, no, I have to offer an apology for comments made earlier in this show. And everybody was absolutely mystified, right? You know, what? Well, I don't remember hearing anything. And then later, when the BBC were asked, what was the apology for? They had to say Len Goodman's reference to foreign muck. Absolutely pathetic, don't you think?
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah. It is pathetic. It's laughable. Yeah. His grandmother said it. Everybody get a grip.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, Miss Jones, I got myself into a bit of trouble this week by arguing quite vociferously on a number of programmes that I've been taking part in that this move to start a four-day working week, but paying people for working 5 days, I says it's going to bankrupt the country. I think it's a mad idea. It's another, you know, craven approach to demands for what do they call it? Wellness, life wellness, or something like that.
Oh, the work-life balance.
Yeah, the work-life balance, wellness, and all that. Look, we can have a work-life balance and wellness when the world is so wealthy that people aren't starving, and you know, people aren't living in terrible accommodation, and lands aren't drying up through drought and all that kind of stuff. It drives me absolutely mad that these people think, oh, you know, money grows on trees. So let's all work 4 days, but get our employer to pay us for 5 days. Honestly, I am appalled by it because, like you, I've brought up and indulged myself in very hard work for decades, never mind years. And I think it's a good example to set to other people.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Everybody's lost sight of the fact that we are facing global food shortages. Yeah. The world is in crisis. It's going to take many years to recover from the effects of the pandemic. Mm. And that hasn't gone away, by the way.
Yeah.
These people I was away in Italy with for the last few days, they are both doctors, one of whom is very senior in the Whitehall setup.
Right.
We happened to be talking about COVID, and I said, it seems to have faded away to a large extent now. Mm. And she said, on the contrary.
Yeah.
It's still out there. It's still killing people.
Yeah.
It still exists on a global scale. Mm. And I said, why are we not hearing about the numbers? And she said, well, obviously, because we're not testing people anymore. Mm. So the numbers are not being reported. Mm. But it's still a problem. It's not gone away. And so all of the impact on the economy, not only ours, but around the world, is still happening. And people, you are right, need to be putting more hours in rather than fewer in order to get our country to recover.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what a wonderful eulogy that was, Miss Jones. I'm enamoured by that somebody's actually thinking like I am, because I just don't get this work-life balance. I did a couple of TV shows recently in which people were demanding, pay increases for everybody in the NHS and everywhere else. Yes, of course, we all, you know, would like to see people paid properly, but money doesn't grow on trees. And if there's one thing that really gets me whenever I have this argument is I always ask the question, where do you think wealth comes from? Because it, you know, it doesn't just come from fresh air. To pay people in the public sector a decent salary, which we all want to do, you've got to have other people creating the wealth. And if you try and penalise the other people, then, you know, the world just, it would just collapse. I had another row about private jets, by the way. Everybody wants to ban private jets now because Harry and Meghan flew on a private jet from LA. But to be honest, I'm not a great critic of that. I couldn't expect them really to fly in a first-class aeroplane for 16 hours from LA to London, could you?
Well, yeah, except what about the carbon footprint?
Well, you know, exactly. But I mean, look, the world's not perfect. You can't suddenly say, right, kill all private jets, because private jets are, they are used by rock stars and you know, very highly paid sportsmen and women. But I'm afraid that it's a very small percentage of people use private jets, and mostly they are used in business for businessmen who run corporations like McDonald's worldwide to get from A to B, to keep the business rolling. The business is rolling and tens of thousands of people are employed by that business, and it makes it more efficient.
Yeah, that's true. And my mother lives near Biggin Hill Airport.
Yeah, right.
So flying over her front and back gardens multiple times a day,
yes, that's right,
are these Learjets.
Yes.
You know, delivering captains of industry who then are met by their limousines and driven into London.
Yeah, that's brilliant,
and so on.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So yeah. And another place is Manston Airport,
yeah,
down in Kent.
That's Paul McCartney's place, isn't it?
No, he's down in Sussex, isn't he? Down in Peasmarsh is where.
Yeah,
his,
but I think he's also got a place in Rye, which I think.
Yeah, it's kind of the same place.
Oh,
he's
is
got
it?
A
oh,
recording
okay.
studio with the windmill down
oh,
there.
Oh, okay, yes. Yeah, yeah, sure, yeah, okay, yeah. Sorry.
But yeah, you look, they are not going to get on
no.
scheduled flights. They're just not going to. It's too precarious. The security aspect of all of that
exactly.
is monumental. So I do see the point.
Yeah.
But I am troubled by the aspect of the carbon footprint.
Yeah, well, you know, like I say, the world's not a perfect place. You've got to make some allowances. We can't suddenly go back to trying to provide transport the way it was provided in medieval times. When Greta Thunberg went to a conference in America and said, I'm going to sail there in a sailboat because I won't have a carbon footprint. But it took 2 weeks to get there. Well, you know, if we all had to spend 2 weeks getting from Europe to America, we would be back in the medieval times and the economy would collapse and everything. But anyway, look, that's another story. I have a fantastic headline in front of Miss Jones, and you are going to clap and cheer. It says, cheers, the boozy lunch is back. Limited days in the city for hybrid workers mean a Tuesday blowout is now the new Friday night. And she says, we're all going out in the lash, and Tuesday is now the day. Tuesday was never really our day, was it, Miss Jones? It was Thursday, wasn't it?
Definitely Thursday. Yeah, always Thursday. And then you'd end up in the Groucho Club on a Thursday night,
yep,
where it would be live music and the whole bit.
Yep.
And then you'd get absolutely wrecked, and the weekend would start the next day. Mm. Yeah, they were different times,
yes,
of course. But, you know, they talk about the golden rules of the liquid lunch. I think,
yep,
this is the piece you're referring to.
Yes.
I always thought there's only one golden rule, really. Which was, don't go back to work if you're pissed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I've had to pursue that one quite a few times, believe me. But here's some of the golden rules of the liquid lunch. Number one, draft two or three coherent emails before arriving at the restaurant and store them on your phone. That's good advice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Start with a martini or a glass of champagne. Drink it fast, then order your first bottle of wine. This puts paid to any illusion that you will be returning to the office. So you've made your mind up already, okay? Yeah.
Yep.
Three, expect to dine for at least 2.5 hours. 2.5 hours? You're joking.
Well, I haven't even had your starter by then.
Exactly. Try six. And order as many courses are on offer. Four, inevitably a colleague will be off the terps, i.e. off the drink. Under no circumstances mention it. Minding about sobriety is a pathetic look in 2022. It needn't stop you getting stuck in. Number five, send the first of your draft emails. Number six, remind everybody that France is 20% more productive than the UK, which amounts to a whole day off a week. I'm not quite sure about why that's relevant, but I do.
Oh, it's to do with the French drinking red wine with all their meals.
Yes, I suppose you're right. Yeah, exactly. But they're still more productive, so drink must be good for you. No, I think I told you, didn't I? I went to Alvino's recently in Fleet Street and met an old Fleet Street colleague, and I must say, it did bring back the memories. On a couple of occasions, I definitely didn't go back. Now, you, of course, are, you know, a celebrity writer, and you could always claim, I suppose, in those days, I don't think we even had mobile phones, did we? But you'd always go to the phone in the restaurant, couldn't you? Ring your desk and say, look, I won't be back. I'm onto a great thing. We're going off to another place to have another drink, and I'm getting a great interview. So that would be your excuse, because you're a writer. But I was the boss. I was the news editor. And if I decided that after the fourth bottle, it probably wouldn't be right to go back, there was a sort of unwritten agreement. I would ring the editor, Sir Nicholas Lloyd, and he probably wouldn't be there anyway. He was probably out somewhere. But I'd speak to his secretary and say, look, tell Nick that I'm, you know, interviewing this afternoon, and I won't be into the 4 o'clock conference. And then I usually, my deputy was with me, actually, a guy called Ian Walker, and I'd say, and Ian's coming with me as well. So we'd send the number three into conference, but it was all forgotten by the next morning. It was kind of accepted that those excesses of our job in Fleet Street were part of the work pattern, really.
Oh, and didn't we turn out much more scintillating newspapers?
Of course we did.
There was a rule, and this was a spoken rule, actually, that if you were sitting at your desk as a reporter or a feature writer, if you were there at your desk in the office, you weren't doing the job, because you had to be out there getting the stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, if that required you to phone them in, as we would say, which was to go and find a phone box somewhere, pick up the phone, dial the copy takers, and then dictate the story down the phone, which you can perfectly easily do when you're three sheets to the wind.
Indeed.
Without any notes, because we didn't make notes in those days. We didn't record anything.
No, I would just write, sometimes when I did that as a reporter, I'd just write two or three words on a napkin or something and then go to the phone and put it all together in my head.
Yeah, newspapers were much more interesting to read back then, is all I'm saying. So there was no harm was done by the boozy lunch.
Yeah.
And I can remember the beginnings of quite a number of boozy lunches.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the endings of them.
No.
But that's all part of the fun. Yeah. And, of course, we half lived in Joe Allen, which was just up the road.
Yeah, that's right.
Which was our office canteen, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. I totally agree.
The old Joe Allen with the great big dining room.
In Exeter Street.
That's right. Yeah. The world changed when that closed down.
It's just around the corner now, and I went there for the first time a few weeks ago. I have to say, I do like it. I was suitably impressed that it's
too small, I think.
It is a bit too small.
And you've got that sort of downstairs bit, which is a bit like having lunch in a swimming pool with lots of furniture in it.
I totally agree. Well, funny enough, I've only been there once, and I was lucky enough to get a table on the upstairs bit. You know, I didn't ask for it, but I just got it, so I was quite pleased. But no, I understand what you're saying. I'm delighted, Miss Jones, that Nottingham Forest are back in the Premiership, Premier League, I should say, because, of course, my alma mater was the University of the Trent. It'll give me an excuse to go to Nottingham when Everton play there and look up all my old haunts. And my goodness me, I was only there 12 months, but I tore that town to pieces.
Yeah, I bet you did. Is that the reason you left?
Yes. I won the snooker competition at the university. I won the darts competition at the local pub. I beat a News of the World champion. And that's basically all I did, play snooker, play darts, and, of course, booze endlessly in a pub called Ye Old Trip to Jerusalem, which is said to be Britain's oldest pub, is built in the side of Nottingham Castle, and of course was home to Robin Hood and his band of merry men. And on that note, Miss Jones, we will say goodbye again to the audience. Thank you very much for having joined us, and we will be back with you again next week. He is a badly damaged Prime Minister with 41% of his backbenchers indicating they don't have any confidence in him anymore. But at the same time, old Petronella Wyatt comes along and says, I think I'll stick the boot in here and talk about the illicit affair. I think that might be bad form, Miss Jones.
I think it's very bad form on her part. It doesn't make her look good. It makes her look like a slapper.
Yeah.
You know, this was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a very long time ago.
He's been in and out of two marriages since then. Well, he's still in the current one. But, you know, you are not the same person. Yeah. I think we change in a cellular way, in a biological way. Every 7 years, we are a completely different person. Mm. Not to mention psychologically and everything else he's gone through as well. He is not the person she had an affair with.
Start with a martini or a glass of champagne, drink it fast, then order your first bottle of wine. This puts paid to any illusion that you will be returning to the office. So you've made your mind up already, okay? Yeah?
Yep.
Three, expect to dine for at least 2.5 hours. 2.5 hours? You're joking.
Well, I haven't even had your starter by
exactly. Then. Try six.
I always thought there's only one golden rule, really. Which was don't go back to work if you're pissed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. I've had to pursue that one quite a few times, believe me.